Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your entrepreneurial peers on the journey of self-leadership mastery and life success. Reinvent or evolve yourself as you redesign your business. Dual innovation. Take charge of who you next become. Feel more deeply to think, act, lead, and mentor more clearly and more effectively. Learn something new from our conversation today.
Yes, Nancy, that was really easy and wonderful for me. You are a very easy person to engage with. You asked great questions and helped guide me, and you also allowed me to go in my own direction in terms of how I answered. I don't know if I got the exact answer to your questions, but you allowed me to go in a direction which I felt would be of interest to your listeners as it relates to my story.
Welcome to We Mentor Mondays. I'm Nancy. And today's guest, we're continuing the saga of the amazing Hondo, his backstory of how he became the magician that he is today and decades later. And there's some incremental pieces about his background that can help you piece together your own background so you can see the direction that you're going to be going by the steps that you're building. And the things that he added into a life that is so unique and scarce, and yet the marketplace really has needed a magician and different types of magicians who can add in the things that he is sought after for, because he believes in magic with a message. He's a sought-after speaker, entertainer, MC, and auctioneer. His engaging, personalized, humor-filled presentations have inspired and captivated worldwide audiences for three decades, primarily in business, educational, sporting, and nonprofit sectors. And I would like to say that he has really worked with some of the greats, like Muhammad Ali and Arnold Palmer, how he got into a special event. You'll be hearing about that today. And so we're carving out his story about the beauty of his work, but also what inspired him about a personal tragedy that happened in his life. So here we go. Thanks for joining me, Hondo. How are you?
I'm great. Nice to be with you for round two.
Excellent. So we left off in the first part of your upbringing, where you grew up in a 1950s home. You described it as authoritarian, and what was impressed upon you was to be obedient and independent. You're the second of four kids, and the message to be seen and not heard was really common in those who parented in the 50s and I would say in the 60s, because I was born in the 60s and I felt that message as well. And then we moved to a dairy farm, and I just felt like the work ethic, that you work hard and do good work. And you at an early age became really focused in on math. And I'm not surprised, like your dad was a chief loan officer. So did you learn some of the math from him?
Well, prior to that, he worked for the IRS and he prepared tax returns. And I remember dad having the whole dining room table filled with spreadsheets and papers for when he was doing taxes for his clients. And in those days, pre-computer, you had to do everything by hand. And mom on the typewriter, she would type out the things. But yeah, I'd sit there and dad would let me watch him do the math when he would calculate. And occasionally he'd say, okay, you've got this column. And I'd say, okay. So we would team up on that occasionally. And I remember one time the next door neighbor, he was doing, I think it was Larry Bouchard, who lived next door to us. And he had just gotten out of college or something, or was in college and had a job and had a tax return. And he was talking about algebra and he was talking about variables like X and Y. And I hadn't gotten to that yet. So I'm thinking, how can you add an X and a Y together? They're letters. And he says, no, they represent numbers. I said, but they're not numbers, they're letters. He says, you'll learn that later. Okay.
That's cute. Oh, so do you think your dad was passionate about what he was doing?
I think he took it seriously. And I think in those days, a lot of that was It was your job. You had to make a living. So whatever it took to put bread on the table, you did it. And he was good with numbers. He was good with math. And whether or not he enjoyed it, I really don't know, because I think it was stressful with all the deadlines of getting the returns done by April 15th. And when he was the loan officer, he didn't talk much about that other than to say it's not easy to tell. Remember, he had someone from the Minnesota Vikings, one of the famous Vikings, came in, wanted a loan, and Dad wasn't able to authorize it. And it was hard on him because he was a very compassionate man who it was hard for him, I think, to tell people no. But that was his job. I don't think I would have liked that job.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you ended up teaching at your alma mater, Creighton Durham Hall High School, and you spent 9 years there, and you started to get the inklings and validation that your magic was really taking on kind of a life of its own when you were asked to speak at the National Council about Mathemagic. Was that the name that you came up with?
What, Mathemagic?
Yeah.
I think I did. It's been out there, and others have used it, but it just seemed to have a nice flow. It made sense to me.
Yeah. And so with all these subtleties that were coming up and changes at the high school that you were teaching at, it provided the framework for you to take a huge risk. Do you think it was the biggest risk in your lifetime?
No question about it. I was giving up a sure salary, albeit not a great one, teaching in a Catholic high school in the 70s and early 80s, our salaries, just by way of your listeners, my first salary was $7,500. And in my ninth year with a master's, it was $16,500. Now, that's not a lot of money by today's gauge, but I found a way to make it work. And I realized that when you go into high school teaching, you're not doing it for the money. You're doing it because you feel you're called to do it. And that was my calling. I was good at math. I was good at coaching sports. I was good at relating to kids. And I didn't care how much money I was making, as long as it was enough. And I lived a lifestyle where it was enough. But when I made the decision to morph from math teacher to full-time magician, I also wasn't doing it for the money, because I didn't know if I was going to make any or not. But I figured things would work out if my dream had roots. And by roots, whenever someone has a dream for a business or anything, you have to break it down into pieces. And those pieces are like plants, and you have to put the root in the ground. And so my pieces were, A, am I good enough at my craft? And I felt that, yes, I am. B, can I stand in front of an audience and deliver the goods? Yes, I can, because I had been doing it for 9 years in front of my students. And I figured, if you can hold the attention of high school students for an hour, five times a day, teaching something some of them aren't interested in learning, how hard is it going to be to stand in front of an audience and entertain them with magic and mystery and laughter and humor and messages pertinent to who they are? How hard is that going to be? And I thought, that's a no-brainer. Now, the third route, and the most important from a standpoint of making a go of it, is the business route. In other words, you can be the world's greatest entertainer. You can be, skill-wise, you can be perfect in front of an audience. But if you're not getting booked, it's not going to work. It's like the old starving artist syndrome. A lot of talented people out there unable to make a living, even though they're definitely good enough to do so. So the third route was the one I focused the most on that first summer after I left teaching.
Because that's the gap that any person needs to bridge. And that's the difference between an entrepreneur and a non-entrepreneur. An entrepreneur figures out the path to make it work.
I had a couple major strikes against me. I had never taken a business class. I hadn't, no business management, no marketing skills, none of that. But I had one thing that I trust immensely, and that was my gut. And my gut told me that I'm good enough to do this. But I had to explore a little more thoroughly how I was going to grow the third root, because it's not good enough for me to say, hey, I'm the best in the business at what I do, even if I believe it. It's not good enough for me to say I'm the best in the business, because that's my opinion. But whose opinion matters more? The audience. So the only way you can evaluate what it is you're bringing to the marketplace, whether it's entertainment or a product or any service, you have to evaluate the response of the people who you are serving. And I was very in touch with that. And I felt like if I can be good enough in the eyes of the right audiences, they'll spread the word and that will lead to more work. And I always said, yeah, one, you're successful in the world of magic, in my case, when you get hired, not because you're a magician, but because it's you. They can get another magician anywhere. There's a lot of them out there, but there's only one me. If I'm speaking to the listener now, whatever it is you are going to do or offer,
it fits for me too.
someone else does what we all do.
Yeah.
But there's only one of us. So we need to identify, why would they choose me over the others? And a lot of people think it's money. It's not money. It's audience experience. Am I the right fit for your audience? Mark LeBlanc, one of my small business mentors, wrote a beautiful little book on small business development. And one of the things he says in there is, you know, if you need to determine your best fit for who hires you, and then you got to let them know that you're there for them. And he says you have to engage in a lot of meaningful conversations with people who can make the decision to hire you, as opposed to just random talking to people who maybe can't hire you. That's the targeted thinking you need.
Yeah, absolutely. Beautiful. You have a knack for asking yourself really important questions. There's no bullshit in those questions.
Thank you.
The other thing is, I think that teachers are natural marketers because they're selling education, and the platform helped you for 9 years to really engage with your students and sell them on that it's cool to be a math geek, is what I imagine you did.
And I didn't even take it to the math geek level. I wanted the jocks, and I wanted the guys who thought they were too cool for stuff. I wanted them to see that math is like a sport. It's a brain game. It's an exercise. And I'll give you, here's a quote was asked of me late in my teaching career by one of my senior students who was frustrated because it was rough on him. He says, let me ask you a question, Hondo. He says, when are we ever going to use all this stuff in life, this math? And I said, point blank, I said, I'll be honest with you. 90% of you will never use 90% of this again in your life. But 100% of you will use 100% of what it did to you and your reasoning process and your brain for having learned it.
Mm-hmm.
And they accepted that. And I said, the ability to think and to reason and to solve problems, that only comes about by doing so. And so I provided what I thought was entertaining yet challenging homework. And I was not the kind of teacher who taught by rote memorization. I didn't teach. Sure, I gave shortcuts and formulas and so on. A squared plus B squared equals C squared. But I wanted to go deeper. I wanted to teach why this stuff works. So I got into a deeper level of understanding. And I told the students, if you can understand the roots of this stuff, then you don't have to remember the formulas, because you can recreate them if you need them.
So you help them even use their imagination to develop some ways to think about it.
And here's one other thing I remember doing, because I consider myself a creative problem solver. I get as much joy today in spending the 8 or 12 hours of prep that may go into a corporate presentation of magic with a message. I get as much joy out of the creative process of preparing my presentation as I do in delivering it, because I know that the delivery is going to be better as a result of doing my homework. And that's what makes each presentation that I give unique to the other one. They're all made to order. There's nothing canned about it. And so I'm a one of a kind. Everybody gets their own show with their own language. And so back to how that was influenced in my teaching. So let's say I gave the students three or four homework problems that were, you know, challenging. You had to think your way through them. I would say extra credit if you can come up with an alternative way to solve it other than the way I showed you. Because there's more than one way to solve a problem, right? There's a lot of ways to get from point A to point B. So I was always teaching creativity.
Yeah, and you've applied. So everything you were doing, you applied, which made it even more meaningful for the students and gave them ways to think about it and reasoned with them. That's really awesome. And that approach, I can see that I can hear you apply to your profession as well as a magician. So how did your first brochure come about? What was that process like?
Sure. I asked myself the question, what is it that the potential buyer needs to see in order to pull the lever and say yes to booking me? And I boiled it down to three things. This is all before PCs, before the internet. This is old school stuff. And it had to be written down. The three things I came up with was, and I think it holds true today, even though we use different means of communicating it. But one, you have to tell them what you do in terms of how it's going to benefit them. Two, you got to tell them who you've done it for. They don't want to be the first customer. You got to tell them who you've done it for. Give notable examples. Three, what did the people who used you have to say about it? What was their reaction? Get high quality testimonials. So if you can tell people what you do, who you've done it for, and that you have a track record and that you have good feedback, good testimonials, now people are going to go, well, if it's good enough for those folks whose names I perhaps recognize, it's good enough for me. But my challenge was, I don't have notable names here.
So then right.
I decided I got to get me some notable names. I took every opportunity to get in front of an influential person or audience who I could say I performed for. And a couple come to mind. I went to the Minneapolis business page and the Pioneer Press business page early on in my career, and I wanted to look at the business listings to see who's got a conference, where can I go? And I saw one called ASPI, American Society for Performance Improvement. And I still remember the guy's name who was in there. I think it was Rob Lawton. And I called the guy up, didn't know him from Adam. I told him, hey, here's who I am. Here's what I'm doing. I'm brand new at this. I need to get in front of an audience. I'm not going to charge you. Could I come and do something at your conference just to show you what I do? And if you like it, maybe I could use you as a reference. And he said, yes. I had another one. I wanted to get into the world of professional golf entertaining because I knew corporate people sponsor golf. So I had a friend with Minnesota Golf Association. And he had a friend. We didn't have any tournaments here. There was one in Chicago called the Western Open. So he introduced me to the tournament director. I sent a letter to the tournament director offering to come down for free. I said, I just want you to see what I do. So I did that one. They loved it. I could now put that on my resume. I had another one where I was in Boston doing a show for 3M at a trade show early in my teaching career. I had to take a couple of days off for school. There was a snowstorm that night and there was no meeting, but there was a Boston Celtic game. So I got on the L train or whatever it was, and I took the subway or whatever it was down to the Boston Garden by myself, bought a ticket from a scalper outside, went inside, watched the game. When the game was over, I walked down toward the locker room of the Boston Celtics because there was a player by the name of Kevin McHale, who was a rookie or a second year player who had just graduated from the University of Minnesota. And he knew me from having performed at his basketball camp. So the guard said, may I help you? I said, yes, I'm here to see Kevin McHale. He said, what do you mean you're here to see Kevin McHale? What are you talking about? You can't see Kevin McHale. I says, yeah, I'm a friend of Kevin McHale's. He said, yeah, you and about 20,000 of the rest of these people in here. He's a typical East Coast brat kind of guy. And I loved it. And I said, no, seriously. He says, here's my business card. You go back and show it to him. So he goes back and he comes back. And he says, okay, I now understand you are who you say you are. Kevin says, come on back. So I go back, and there's a party in the basement of the Boston Garden in one of the sponsor club rooms. And Kevin says, you got any magic on you? One thing you learn in my craft, you always have some magic in your pockets. So I ended up doing an impromptu show for the Boston Celtics at the Garden. Now I can put that on my resume. But the best one, and it was when we were in Orlando, Florida for spring training for the Twins. And I knew that Arnold Palmer's golf tournament, the Bay Hill Classic, was going on at the same time. And I had reached out to that tournament several times to see if they'd book me, and I never got anywhere. And I thought, geez, this is one I want to do. And I had my tux with me, I remember. I had all my magic with me, and because I had performed at the Twin spring training. But I wanted to also take it over to Arnie's tournament, but I wasn't hired. So I remembered a quote from Earl Nightingale. He was one of the early motivational gurus, and I had his tapes called Lead the Field. And one of the things that Earl Nightingale said was, act as though you're already where you want to be, and you'll be more likely to get there. So I thought, I want to be at Arnold Palmer's tournament, but they didn't hire me. So I got in my rental car, put my tux on, put my magic briefcase in my hand, and I went there. And I said, I'm just going to go do it. I walked in, and of course, they said at the check-in desk, may I help you? I said, yes, I'm here for the entertainment. No, okay, go ahead. So I walked right by. I actually went in and performed for 2 or 3 hours at the tables at Arnold Palmer's Pro-Am banquet, and I was never hired to do it. But I did it. So now I can put it on my brochure. So those are some of the things I did to beef up my client list.
Well, and it worked.
It did work. And the other thing I think that you have to do if you're like, I'm a one-off booking. I'm only as good as my next booking right now. And I get hired, I show up, I do it, I get paid. The next gig, you get hired, you show up, you do it, you get paid. Well, back to Mark LeBlanc, you have to have meaningful conversations with qualified decision makers in order to turn a conversation into a booking. And there's two ways those calls can occur. One is the call can come into you, and the other is the call can go out from you. Now, early in our career, for everybody who's starting a business, 90% of those calls have to go outward because you're asking for people to help you. You're asking to go perform. And it wasn't about the money early on. It was about developing a resume and a track record. So outgoing calls. Now, once the incoming calls past the 50% mark, when you can get more calls coming in than are going out, now I think you're in the right direction, because now it's a lot easier to sell yourself to someone who's asking for you than for you putting yourself to them.
Yeah.
So I think everybody's strategy has to be, how do I get inquiries coming in?
Yeah, absolutely. And so that was a formula that started really working with you. So 31, you go in and you springboard into your livelihood that you feel you're called to do. And you run like crazy and start building out your career during the next 9 years.
Yes, yes, for sure. Definitely the first 4 or 5 years in the full-time mode was trying to parlay one engagement into another. If you can get 2 phone calls from every appearance you do, well, that's a geometric progression, which it's the old math puzzle, which if you haven't heard it, I'll share it with you. You tell a person, put a penny in your piggy bank on the first of the month, double it every day, 2 cents the next day, 4 cents the next day, 8 cents the next day. What will you have at the end of the month? People don't understand the magnitude of this, but you're going to have a lot of money. I don't know the exact number because I just thought of it now, but it's in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, I believe. And it seems possible, but that's the beauty of exponential growth. And so 2 calls from every appearance, you're never going to run out of business. But yes, those first few years, I remember the first year I took the 2 sponge balls that I carry in my pocket. I knocked on office doors and I went in and did little impromptu samples, handed out my business card. I think that December I got booked for maybe 13 or 14 holiday parties. And I think 2 or 3 years later, it was up to 26 corporate holiday parties in the month of December. I remember one Friday in a December, I had six different performances, which I'll never do again. But I was young and stupid, and I said, I like the challenge, but that was a hard day.
I can imagine. Oh, my gosh. Who else was in your household at this point where you were trying to balance out the financial part of the things?
I've been single my whole life. I never been able to magically produce the wife. That might be a whole nother conversation, but I think they're afraid of me being a magician or something, or they think I might disappear, or is this a real profession? It's puzzling to me, but on the other hand, I've not thought too much about it, really. I just think I grew up in a household where I guess I'm being somewhat transparent in what I'm about to tell you, but I grew up in a household where the modeling of parenthood and the modeling of husband and wife that I saw wasn't one that I was drawn to. In other words, I had a critical eye.
Yeah, I can relate. Yeah.
Well, I thought if I had a choice between being single or being in that kind of a situation, I'd take being single. So I never set out to be married for the sake of being married, but I never said I'm never going to get married. I didn't. I just say this is one of those things where I think we know where the divorce rate is. I think a lot of people who get married just to get married because they want to get it over with, a lot of times that doesn't work out so well. So I'm still waiting, but I got to wait till I grow up.
I don't think it's about growing up. I think it's about finding a space in your life where you feel that you could have a companion and you can have it for as long as you want. And I'm sure you've dated.
Oh, absolutely.
And had really good relationships along the way. They haven't led to marriage, but does that necessarily mean your life is less because it hasn't?
I don't think so. But one thing, I think I score pretty good points in the self-awareness category. And one of the things that I realize about myself, and I think this is common with number two children in the birth order, number two, we tend to be people pleasers and we tend to be wanting everybody to be happy and we're like peacemakers and mediators. And as an entertainer and a performer and as a teacher, I was not happy unless every student got it, understood what we were doing. And I would stay after school to help the ones who weren't getting it because I'm an all or nothing kind of guy. And I'm that way when it comes to my profession. And I'm not happy unless the whole audience is happy. So I do everything I can to be really just insecure enough that I have to be really good in front of my audiences. And otherwise, I can't live with myself. I'm a perfectionist in that regard, relative to my craft and relative to my performances. And those traits don't mesh real well with relationships because I feel like in a relationship, I got the same responsibility as I do in my profession, and that is to please my mate. And we all know that's not possible. You're not responsible for somebody else's happiness. So I get that, but that's my confession on that subject.
Okay. Yeah, I can see the quandary that you've been sort living in. And I don't hear that you're asking for any insight. And so I don't have any to give. It seems like you are okay with where you're at. And if anything else surfaces after, you know, this conversation or what have you, you're okay with that too.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I tell this story often. I say, I left teaching in 1984 when it was still all boys. 3 years later, it merged with Durham Hall and became co-ed. Had I been a 9-year teacher in a co-ed school at the start of my teaching career, I am 100% convinced that one of those women would have ultimately, now granted, not at the time, but after college, because I would have had my mind on somebody and someone would have known me so well through the teaching process. You can't hide yourself if you're a teacher. I gave my whole heart and soul to that profession. And so the kids really got to know me and I got to know them. And I think the real you shows up on a daily basis when you're engaging with people.
Yeah.
So I kind of missed out on the fact that I didn't have females in my class.
Yeah. I can see where that would have been a negative. Okay. I appreciate your reflective way in which you look at your life. So how did you then start meeting like all these celebrities? Like you spoke like Harvey McKay and Muhammad Ali and Bob Hope and Diana Shore, and the list goes on.
So I think it probably goes back to my story about performing in Chicago in 85 and for the Western Open Golf Tournament on my dime, because I got a nice letter back from Marshall Dan, the executive director of the Western Golf Association. He was well known in the golf circles for tournaments. And he said, "We'd love to have you back next year. And if you don't mind, we'd like to pay you." And I thought, I like this man. So I went back and did it. So then I did that for two or three years. And he said to me, "There's a convention of tournament directors for people like me who sponsor professional golf tournaments around the world and in the country. And our next one is in Pebble Beach, California. And you should go there and you could buy an exhibit booth and you could get your exposure." So I did that. And I got known by a whole lot of people. And one of them was a fellow named Mike Gillespie, who to this day is one of my best friends. He was running the Dinah Shore Golf Tournament at the time in Palm Springs. And every year in March, the best women golfers in the world on the LPGA would play there. This was a big celebrity event hosted by Nabisco, and they had a big hospitality tent, which felt to me like about the size of a small city block. And I was the guy that they hired to go in and work table to table and keep everybody entertained. Well, they had Hollywood types. They had athletes. I got to perform for Joe DiMaggio, Robert Wagner, John Havlicek, from whom I took the name Hondo. Any of the old schoolers listening to this who follow the NBA will remember John Havlicek, whose nickname was Hondo. He played for the Celtics back in the 60s and 70s. And he was one of my idols. And I grabbed Hondo because Houdini was taken.
So what's your real name?
John Hughes, but I didn't want to be the amazing John or John the Magician. That doesn't flow. And there was a John Hughes who was a film director. I had this sense early on, even though I never knew I was going to do this full time, but when I got the nickname when I was, I think, playing college basketball and teaching at Creighton and coaching, and I just used Hondo as my magic name, originally Hondo the Magician, and then I thought that's too limiting, so I changed it to the Amazing Hondo because it just leaves a little more of the imagination. But that stuck with me. But I realized from a marketing standpoint, I want to have a name that isn't common and that there aren't a whole lot of Hondos floating around. So that's how that came about. But so I meet all these people at the Dinah Shore, all these celebrities and famous people, and one of them was a well-known restaurateur here in the Twin Cities by the last name of Applebaum, Sid Applebaum. That used to be the precursor to a lot of the grocery stores here. And Super Value's CEO used to be out there, and he saw me. Mike Wright was his name, and he hired me to perform at Super Value's 50th anniversary of their company, which was a prestigious gig. We fast forward to Muhammad Ali's story. Harvey McKay, a well-known business author in town, well-known, was doing a book, and he had a chapter on Muhammad Ali. This was in 1997. And he brought Muhammad Ali in for his book signing and to get photos with everybody who bought a book. They had a five-hour window of time in the afternoon prior to the book signing, where they had to keep Muhammad occupied, and they knew that he liked magic. He was a big fan of magic. So Harvey asked his assistant, Greg Bailey, who happened to go to my high school, Creighton High School. He was a classmate of Paul Molitor's, class of 74. I threw all these numbers in here for all the mathematical folks on the podcast. And Harvey asks Greg, "I need a magician. Who do you know?" And since Greg is his personal manager, he says, "I know this guy from my high school, Hondo. He's pretty good." So I get a phone call from Harvey. Now, I'm nervous because Harvey's famous, and I'm not. And Harvey says, "Hondo, this is Harvey McKay." I said, "Yes, sir." He says, "Do you know who I am?" I said, "Yes, sir." He says, "I understand you're the best magician around. Is that true?" And I said, "Harvey, I'm a humble guy, but I agree. Yes, for purposes of working with you, I'm the best option you have." He goes, "That's what I wanted to hear. I got Muhammad Ali in town, and I need you to keep him company all afternoon. Would you be willing to do that?" I said, "Sure." He says, "And then I want you to work my line. I'm going to have long lines at the book signing. People are going to be in line to get a book and get a picture with Muhammad Ali. Can you keep them entertained?" I said, "Yes." And then Harvey, the great negotiator that he is, says to me, "Now, I'll pay you for the second part, working my line, but I think you ought to just do the first part just because it's Muhammad Ali. Are you okay with that?" I go, "Yes, I am." So I have no idea how much money I made, because it doesn't matter. What matters is I got to perform for the most famous person on the planet, Muhammad Ali, a lover of magic. And I tell you what, I was shaking. But once I got started and won his approval, it was the most memorable day performance of my life, I think.
Wow.
And I have a cute story. He said, after watching me for 4 or 5 hours, Patrick Royce was one of the writers. He still writes for the Star Tribune, and he was in the audience for one of them. Now, these audiences, Harvey brought in about 8 people every half hour for 5 hours to sit at a round table with me and Muhammad. And so he'd usher these people in. Sid Hartman was one of them, and other famous local Twin Cities business folks. And Royce, the writer, is sitting there. And I made eye contact with Muhammad Ali. He was sitting next to me. I made eye contact with him, and I didn't say anything, but I communicated a message with my eyes and my hands to him. That communication lasted all of 2 seconds, and no one saw it. But it was a communication that allowed me to have Pat Royce, the writer, select any card from a shuffled deck of cards. He'd look at it, but he wouldn't show Muhammad. And I'd look at Muhammad and I say, I want you to look into his eyes and tell him what card he has. So Muhammad, 4 or 5 times in a row, and Muhammad milked it. I'm seeing a red card. I'm seeing a heart. I think you have the 4 of hearts. And Royce would turn it over and it was the 4 of hearts. Listen, and Royce was bamboozled by this, and he wrote an article about it in the paper the next day. And he had the audacity to suggest that I and Muhammad Ali were in cahoots. Believe me, we were. But the way we got in cahoots was with no words spoken. That's how smart Muhammad Ali was in terms of magic and my eye contact. But my final story on Muhammad, he whispers to me after he's watching me. He says, you think you're amazing? He says, I'll make a comeback. I said, what? He says, I'm coming out of retirement. I said, yeah, who are you going to fight first? He hesitated, and then he looked at me with a wry grin, and he pointed at me, and he said, you. And I said, how do you think I'll do against you, champ? And he says, with all your jive, I take you in 5. So I went home, the greatest of all time. And I have photographs of that day that to this day I cherish a lot. I had to perform 3 more times.
Oh, really? Wow. I'll include the photos in our show notes so everyone can see that magical moment for you there.
The quick second story, Harvey, I'm in Scottsdale, Arizona, where Harvey has a home, and it's Super Bowl Sunday. He contacted me the day before, and he says, are you in town? I said, I am. He says, I got Muhammad Ali coming over to the house for the Super Bowl. We want you to be the halftime entertainment. I said, you're on. So I get over to Harvey's house. He's got a big old mansion on the north side of Camelback Mountain, and Muhammad Ali's sitting right there in the front row as halftime comes along. Now, it's in a house, and they've got about 40 people gathered around. Right before they turn the TV off, the halftime show for the Super Bowl starting up, and it's none other than Minneapolis's Prince looking at them. And I'm looking at the guy, I said, you guys don't want to watch me do magic. You got Prince is going to be doing the halftime show. And they all said, no, turn the TV off. We want to watch magic. So it was an older crowd, so they'd rather watch me than Prince. We turned the TV off. I do my show, and Muhammad was all smiles. And so I can now tell people that I trumped Prince.
Full rain. The whole city was purple.
And the next, Harvey calls me later that day, and he says, Hondo, you were great. He says, are you busy tomorrow? I says, what do you mean? Tomorrow's Monday. Because I know. He says, I just got a call from the champ. He wants you to stop by the house and show him some card tricks. So I did it. I met with Harvey, and we drive over to Muhammad Ali's home in Paradise Valley. We go inside. He's got the big screen TV on. He's watching ESPN, and he's eating a Burger King hamburger and sipping a Coke, and he's got a bib on, and he's got a TV tray next to him. And when he saw me walk in, he started vibrating and moving, and his head started to bobble, and he says, come on over here, come on over here. They cleaned off his food table, and I proceeded to do some more magic for him. And I have I've got about a 20-second videotape of it that someone did on an old Canon handheld point-and-click camera. But that was pretty cool, being able to be in his house.
Yeah. That's, wow, amazing stories. Yeah. So your career is going along. You're having these amazing experiences. And then your 40th birthday comes around, and a lot happens in your 40s that is just, wow, a lot to take in. So describe what happened in your 40s where the direction of your life changed.
Yes, Nancy. It was a pivotal five-year period between 92 and 97 where I lost both parents and my youngest brother, mother to cancer at age 72. It was like the six-month variety lung cancer. My brother in 95 at the age of, I believe it was the day before his 33rd birthday, and he had some addiction and depression issues and decided he didn't want to be on this earth anymore. And so he took an exit, a self-directed exit, and a father who passed away 5 years to the day after my mother's cancer diagnosis in 97. He had some alcohol issues throughout his life, and I think he had a drinking binge that weekend, and he was found on the floor of where he was living. He must have fainted or passed out on the way to the bathroom to get his blood pressure medication. And so, yeah, I lost half of my family in a five-year span.
And how did that impact your life and your career?
The way that it impacted my life was, and the simplest way I can say this is that when my mother passed away, it really made me, you know, you lose your first parent and you reflect on things. And I was, I believe, 40 years old. And I remember saying to myself, what am I doing? And the answer was, I'm just doing. I'm a human doing. I'm busy. I'm working. I'm looking for that next gig. I'm trying to be the best I can at what I do, all that stuff. I'm a human doing. But when my mom passed, I took a step back for probably a good few months. And I decided I'm tired of being a human doing. I want to take a closer look at what it means to be a human being. And without getting too philosophical, I think when you explore yourself as a human being, you look at your purpose, you look at your path, you look at where's the joy in life, and what do you want to do going forward? And so that was the big thing that happened when that happened. Now, when my brother, 3 years later, he exits, and I find out with a hard rap at the front door on a Saturday morning, I was sleeping in and it was like 8:30, 9 o'clock, hard rap at the front door. And I walk and there's two police officers there. And I'm going, what are they doing here? And they say, are you John Hughes? I said, yes, I am. And your father is John Hughes? I said, yes, he is. We tried to reach him, but we couldn't get to him. So we had to come to you. And they informed me that my brother Mark was at the Hennepin County morgue. And I wasn't shocked because I had been through a lot with my brother, and he'd gone through treatment 6, 7, 8 times, and he was battling this whole thing. But when it happens, that's another moment where you step back. And my father was the trifecta a couple years after that. So I'm an orphan now, and my youngest brother was my best friend in terms of being someone who I could see in him. Me. He couldn't see in me him. A reason I could see in him me is because I was older and I had experienced emotionally a lot of what I felt he was experiencing. Of course, he didn't see it that way because
there were 10 years age difference between the two of you, right?
Yeah. He's looking the other direction. And he, without him taking me down to Eagle Magic Store that Saturday, the summer before my senior year, I would never be doing what I'm doing now. No way. Because it was because he took me down to that magic store where he'd been taking lessons from Larry Kahlo, the owner. And I got introduced to Al Schneider and took his lessons. Had that not happened, there's absolutely no way I would be doing what I'm doing now. So I have my brother Mark to thank for that. He was a musician, a guitar player, a singer, a comedian. When I had a performance at the World Theater for a charity event, I was the headliner at the Fitzgerald Theater back in the mid-80s, and I put my brother Mark on the docket to sing a song. And we were both big fans of Cat Stevens, and so my brother played a beautiful version which I have on cassette tape somewhere. I can't find it, but it's in my house somewhere. I need an organizational helper. He did a song called Where Do the Children Play by Cat Stevens. And it just reminded me that there's a child in every one of us, and no matter how old we are. And that child needs to be nourished and entertained and inspired and challenged. But sometimes that child loses the battle. And sadly, he did. And the daughter at the time, who was 4 years old, and now she's 30. Maybe she was younger than that, but now she's 30, and I'm her godfather and uncle, and I had lunch with her last week. The circle of life keeps rolling on.
Yeah, that's for sure. So again, you return to some really tough questions with yourself. Now, you grew up in a family then that had some alcohol, as you describe, alcohol issues. How did you not continue down that path?
When I was in high school, I was a pretty shy, introverted guy, and I didn't have confidence. And that's part of what got me into magic, to give me something I could have that was not what everybody else had. But I saw it in my home. I saw what was going on. I saw my father's condition. I saw how he treated mom sometimes, and how whenever we were going to go somewhere on a family trip, the night before, he would overdo it. I think he was nervous and he'd overdo it. And the next morning, we wouldn't be able to get out of the house and he wouldn't smell very good. And he was a 3-pack-a-day smoker. And I think my mom was a pack to pack and a half. So I grew up with elements that I didn't care for. So I got out of the house as much as I could. Never smoked a cigarette in my life. Tried it one time, couldn't stand it. And I thought to myself, why would anybody do this? And never took a drop of alcohol till I think I was a freshman in college in Denver. My freshman year, I went to Regis. And I think I had a couple beers that year. I said, well, I got to find out for myself. But yeah, has that affected my career and my life? I can absolutely say it has, because when you grow up in the situations that emotionally derail you when you're young, you want to do whatever you can to avoid that and escape it. So for me, my escapism was mathematics, magic, and sports. Those were my forms of escapism when I was young. I didn't want to choose the same escapism that was affecting my household. I was a pretty lonely guy, not lonely from the standpoint of feeling like I don't exist, just lonely from the standpoint of I was chasing down my own dream, my own path. And I was very lucky to find, and this may be for another conversation, but I was very lucky to find a mentor through baseball, another one through mathematics, and another one through magic. And I think that we all need to think about, everybody thinks it's your parents that are the most important people in your life. There might be other people who are your inspiration and your heroes.
Yeah, I think if we're not getting our emotional needs met, we need to give ourselves permission to go somewhere else, because the need is still there.
Exactly. And some people, sadly, don't find those other people. And I was so lucky that I did. I was 16 when I met one of them, and 17 when I met the other one, and 22 when I met the magic guy, Al Schneider.
Those were pivotal points in your life where you needed mentors to help you navigate your next, your life, and your career.
My summer baseball coach, Billy Peterson, was the first person that ever gave me confidence in myself. He believed in me when I did not even believe in myself. I wasn't taught to believe in myself. I had to learn that, and he gave me the permission to do so, and I stay in touch with him to this day. Cute little aside story, about 10 days ago, my brother Jim, 3 years younger than me, and I, he also played American Legion ball for Billy Peterson. We called him up. We said, can we go to your field? He's got a field named after him on Marshall Avenue in St. Paul, right next to Central High School, called Billy Peterson Field. I said, can we go over and reenact a baseball practice? Can you hit me ground balls? I want to throw them to my brother. And can we hit some balls in the batting cage? And he said, sure. So here we are at this advanced stage of life, going back with our hero and having a repeat.
Yeah, amazing. So it sounds to me like, Mark, when you reflect back, was an inspiration to you in his love of the gifts that he had?
Yeah, I think there can be inspiration in tragedy and loss. And how do you honor someone's memory and who was important in your life? And I guess one of the things that I try to do is be true to my craft and true to my purpose. And since he was such a big part of both of those, I feel like he's in every audience watching me when I'm performing. And I sometimes listen to, I'm still looking for the recording of the song he did at that charity event. But I listen to Cat Stevens play Where Do the Children Play? And I'll listen to, we both were big Bruce Springsteen fans, and I'll listen to Bruce's version of Prove It All Night, because I think that no matter what, you do have to prove it all night, every night, in whatever you do. And you can't take a day off. You can't be mediocre for one audience and wonderful for another audience, because the mediocre one's wondering, well, what's the deal? And so I think my career has been the greatest therapy for my own bouts of downness or depression or whatever may enter the equation, because nothing gets me out of myself more than being performing and engaging with others and being able to put smiles on people's faces and expand their joy. Is it doesn't get any better than that. So I am a bit of a slave to my own drug, which is doing what I do. And Mark was a big part of that and always will be.
Yeah. Part of what you're talking about, too, is a resiliency strategy, which is helping others when you're feeling sad yourself. It's a very beautiful technique to use to revive yourself. And with you having a penchant for asking some really honest questions of yourself, like what's your purpose, your path, and where's the joy in your life, those are the things that help you navigate through these very deep, dark tragedies that occur in our life at different times.
And I think, too, I look at my own way of approaching life, so much of it is through my brain, that when I'm performing, I can turn my brain off and I can trust my intuition and I can just be improvisational and I can feel and feed off my audience, and that will determine my next comment or my next statement or whatever I'm going to do. But you can only go so far in thinking your way through your emotions. And so I think that I've often said that I could be a better therapist to other people than I can to myself. It's always easier to address other people's problems than your own. I actually do a trick in my performance, which is a marriage magic trick, where I joke that I've never been married, but I can be a marriage therapist for you guys. Yeah, I'll work it out. And I can answer. I'm an answer man, but sometimes I can't find them for myself, though. But
and maybe that's the next part of your journey.
Yeah. I think constantly being self-aware. And I think the older I get, the more I appreciate how it all began. And that is as the math teacher. And so now with Zoom, and I have a Zoom studio that I'm sitting in as we speak.
Hondo, I'm wondering if we can add this into our next segment, because that is really a nice segue.
Sure.
Okay. Before you start that, I wonder if we could close out with the appreciation that you have.
Yes. Appreciation for the people that truly inspired me. My coach, Billy Peterson, my math teacher, Paul Perley, who one day let me teach the classroom in calculus, and another day he let me do magic show for my classmates. And those two experiences that Prof. Perley allowed me to do in senior year of high school are the only two things I've done with my life professionally. So he was pivotal. And then Al Schneider, from whom I learned all the sleight of hand stuff that I've built on in my career. So having those kind of mentors, and then, you know, the relationship with my little brother and that kind of inspiration, and everything else. It's just been a great journey. You never know. It's like magic. And when you're watching magic, you never know what's going to happen next. And so I feel that way about my life. And maybe I will end up going back to teaching in combining magic with teaching somehow. So we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. You're always reinventing yourself. And we'll be talking about that in our next conversation about staying on top of your craft. All right. Great. So Hondo, thank you so much for just going into the deeper waters underneath the surface to give us some nice picture of who you are as a person, as John Hughes. Just beautiful.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for tuning in. And thanks, Mike Cabea, sound engineer,
videographer, and mon frère de notre mère, brother from another mother. I can trip that up when I want. All right. We'll see you all next week. Keep listening.
Do you want to build upon your leadership skills and become effective as a business owner? Do you want to evolve yourself as you redesign your business? You can. We know that dual innovation with mentoring works. We've mentored thousands of emerging to experienced entrepreneurial leaders and small business owners in this dual innovation process since 1992. We are here to co-create a mentoring process where you can nourish resilient relationships while you redesign your business. Resilient relationships promote relational literacy, the ability to understand and express healthy ways of relating. Even a slight increase in relational literacy can lead to significant improvement in all of your relationships. So why not take the risk to move out of dysfunctional relating and move into ways to deepen your connection to yourself and others? Assert self-leadership. If you aren't already subscribed to this podcast, go do it now. Go to wementor.com and get the support and skills needed to build a purposeful life journey with your peers on the entrepreneurial leadership path, consciously co-creating our future. You can also join our virtual mentoring community for one-on-one strategic mentoring or participate in a WeMentor lab, because we mentor meaningful conversations and activities that lead to higher levels of functionality and engagement in our world and everything that we do with each other. So engage your curiosity and become the leader you envision yourself to be today. WeMentor.com. Go there. Check it out.